This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The United States Supreme Court last week ruled in a case on race-based affirmative action policies used by Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. The 6-3 ruling had all the court's conservative justices voting to end efforts by higher education institutions to increase racial diversity on campuses. The case was brought by a conservative organization claiming that Asian Americans are harmed by preferences for people of other non-white races and used Asian students as a wedge against Black, Latino, Indigenous, and other communities of color. More importantly, it left preferences for wealthy white students intact in the form of legacy admissions and other wealth-based modes of entry. My guest is Dr. Omekongo Dibinga, a professor of intercultural communication at American University, where he also serves as a faculty affiliate to the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. He's the author of the new book, Lies About Black People, How to Combat Racist Stereotypes and Why It Matters. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So first, how do you respond to the actual ruling itself? I imagine that those of us who've been paying close attention aren't surprised with this ultra-conservative court that they would see any effort to increase racial diversity as anathema and strike it down, right?
Absolutely. And in the book Lies About Black People, I look at affirmative action and many of the stereotypes that people have had that deal with these issues. And to be quite honest, as frustrated and angry many of us are at the Supreme Court, many of us, we should also look at ourselves as well, because this is also a result of not taking former President Donald Trump seriously when he was running for office. There were also several years and periods where Democrats were in power and didn't do what they needed to do for the protection of voting rights and codifying things relating to Roe v. Wade and the like. And so we also have to be mindful that this is what happens when we let our guard down, when we get comfortable. But back directly to the Supreme Court, some of them should even be on the Supreme Court when you look at some of the things that are happening with the ethics, quote-unquote ethics violations, because they have their own rules with Justice Alito and Thomas and the like. And then when we see what Kavanaugh's story, how did all of those loans get paid off before he came into office, into his position? Those types of issues are very real. And that's why many of us feel like the Supreme Court within itself is corrupt. But here we are with a corrupt organization making laws that are affecting so many people of so many different backgrounds.
Now, the case, I want to dig into how it came about, because it was cast as a way to ensure that Asian Americans were not being discriminated against. And many Asian American groups and individuals have since come forward saying that they support affirmative action policies. And it was actually, it ended up being that this case was brought by a conservative white man named Ed Blum, who I think we should probably be pretty clear, probably doesn't care much about the rights of Asian American people, right?
I doubt it severely. And it kind of goes to what Malcolm X said, you know, whenever a Black person stands up to say something, what the white community will do will find another Black person to automatically come up and say the opposite thing that supports what these white conservatives want to hear. And this is the case with that as well, because at the end of the day, we see that affirmative action policies over the years have primarily benefited white women. Black people haven't even been the number one beneficiaries. But what we do in this country is that we always target Black people first, because those who are against Black progress, they feel like that will get more people on their side. And so when we look at the affirmative action case at Harvard University, and then also at UNC as well, the reason why many Asian students support what was already in place is because they realize that this is not a zero-sum game. They realize that it's not a situation where if a Black person gets in, it means because they got affirmative action over an Asian student. And so when we see this, every single day throughout our history, there have always been examples where people have tried to always put the face of somebody who represents said community, but they're really just puppets. And we see this in this case as well. And so I applaud many of people within the Asian community who have stood up and said that we support affirmative action policies, because we can't turn this into a kind of low level COVID type of thing where anti-Asian sentiment was on the rise and hate crimes against them was on the rise. And it wasn't just white people who were targeting them. So we can't in our own communities have Black and Latino go against Asian and be mad. We need to work in solidarity because that's what they want. They want us to not be unified.
Now, the issue of legacy admissions and of admissions for the children of wealthy donors, that remains intact. No conservative is worried about preferential treatment for wealthy people who tend to be white. And that reveals, doesn't it, that this was basically a white supremacist conservative case and a white supremacist ruling?
Well, and there's another part to it as well, because we got to be mindful of the fact that this country has always had affirmative action policies for white people. When they came here as immigrants and the like, we'd get plots of land. The whole thing about westward expansion, what was about that type of policy as well. And so when we fast forward to the present, one of the things that we also have to be mindful of is even when we compare it to legacy admissions, we're almost equal, not you and I, but I'm talking about the larger conversations, we're almost equalizing it to affirmative action, because when people think about affirmative action, the stereotype is unqualified Black kids are getting into these places and spaces. But we know that these are people with qualifications and the grades, but not the access to this. So sometimes the interviews may happen when people come into a neighborhood, to a community, like Joy Reid talked about when she got into Harvard. They came out and interviewed her. She was already brilliant and have the grades. But legacy admissions, those folks don't have to necessarily be qualified. You see what I'm saying? It's like comparing Jared Kushner to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, right? I mean, when people talk about Kushner's experience, you know, in these schools as well as a legacy student, or let's say George Bush Jr., you know, George H.W. Bush, and you know, the Bush family and him getting in because of legacy, I believe he was a C student in his undergraduate year. So the legacy students, they may not always be qualified. They just may happen to have a parent who has their name on the building, right? And so you are absolutely right when you say that was left alone, because really at the end of the day, people will take these things but so far. And I applaud campuses across the country, universities across the country that have started doing away with legacy. Because I'll be very honest, both my parents went to Harvard. They got PhDs from Harvard. I didn't get in when I applied. So, you know, this legacy thing. You know what I'm saying?
You didn't get into Harvard.
I did not. You know, this legacy thing can only go but so far. I took some classes there when I was doing my graduate work at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, but it's not just a one-to-one ratio as if you had parents who went there. My dad helped reform the Divinity School, helped start the Du Bois Center. They were putting in work there, but they were like, nah, man, I'm not. So this legacy thing is definitely connected to that money side. And like you said, maintaining that legacy of whiteness on these campuses.
George W. Bush, as you mentioned, got into Yale University, and he was definitely not a, you know, let's just say he was a mediocre student. There's even evidence suggesting that JFK, if you go back, you know, to when he applied, I believe it was to Yale as well, or maybe Harvard, one of the Ivies, in the 30s, you know, sort of wrote this off-the-cuff essay to get in. And that is the kind of generational preservation of privilege. One of the things that was, of course, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised, and it goes back to what you were saying earlier, when conservatives basically will take people of color and use them as wedges against other people of color. We see Justice Clarence Thomas, who wrote the opinion on the affirmative action ruling. And if you go back to the 80s, he admitted and said that he was admitted into Yale because of affirmative action policies. He gave a speech saying that this was something that he said, but for them, God only knows where I would be today. These laws and their proper application, laws meaning affirmative action laws, are all that stand between the first 17 years of my life and the second 17 years. Mm-hmm. But apparently in the 80s was the last time that he spoke of the fact that he himself was a beneficiary of affirmative action policies to increase racial diversity. And here we are with his ruling today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if that's not the classic example of somebody climbing up the ladder and then breaking the ladder and kicking it so nobody else can get up there. I can't think of any better example than to say that, oh, it stigmatizes white, black kids, it hurts white kids, and so on and so forth. I mean, he must have stopped talking about it maybe shortly after he met Harlan Crowe. I don't know, but you know,
billionaire known for basically bankrolling his fancy vacations, and
that's right, yeah. That's right,
and his mother's also, house.
Yeah, yep. Hey, I mean, think about Clarence Thomas. I mean, this was a guy who was pretty much identified almost as a Black Panther back in his day. I mean, to see this transition in terms of where he is today, this is a man who seriously has put himself in a position where he says, I got mine and you got yours to get. And this is what the late Justice Thurgood Marshall meant when he said that, don't just try to fill my seat with another Black person, because a Black snake will bite you just as hard as a white snake will, as it relates to not caring about the policies needed in our communities. And Clarence Thomas is the full representation of that right now. And people call him a sellout, but I don't even believe that he ever bought in. After he got to a certain level, he just gave up. And the hypocrisy is real, but the consequences are even realer.
Now, how do you think this ruling will play out in the racial diversity of college campuses? First of all, have we seen affirmative action policies do it enough when they were legal to increase racial diversity? You mentioned that white women were the biggest beneficiaries rather than Black and brown folks. Did they do enough? And with this ruling, will the modest gains be rolled back even further?
The answer to the second part of your question is yes, that the games will be rolled back even further. I went to a school, my high school is called Boston Latin School, so oldest public school in the country. And before a lot of these college cases came out, that was one of the major cases of affirmative action that happened. And when that happened in Massachusetts, the numbers in Boston Latin School plummeted. And you see that today as well. You look at California and their university system as well. When they struck down affirmative action policies, the Black and Latino admission rate, you know, declined by about 50%. And even now, some of those schools within the University of California system have started to make up those numbers, but all of them have not, particularly schools like UCLA. So there's going to be a real decline, and there's going to be a decline for several reasons. One, you obviously got schools that are scared of lawsuits and other things that may come their way. But also, we have to understand that students, we're talking high school students, my daughter's about to be a senior this year in high school, seniors, juniors, people who aren't as in tune with the news as we are, as news junkies and people who do this work, the only message they're seeing is affirmative action is done. I can't apply to this school. I'm not going to be able to get into this school or that school. Even with UNC, which is, you know, state funded, you're going to have a situation where the Black enrollment, Latino enrollment is going to decline, and people are paying the same level of taxes in that state. So we're going to see that as well. And so I know all of these university heads and deans and colleges have come out and said, we are committed and so on and so forth. And I do believe that schools will make sincere efforts. But at the end of the day, we're going to see a situation where if a school increases this number of Black students by like 0.5%, just on merits and everything alone, people are still going to point to it and say it's affirmative action, and there are going to be more lawsuits coming because people just can't accept the fact that qualified Black students are getting in even without affirmative action. So schools are going to have to up their efforts and do what Joyanne Reed was talking about, going out to the community, meeting people. Now, to be quite honest, these admissions committees have been doing a lot of this work for a long time, so they can see zip codes and know what the population is. They know what the populations of some of these high schools are. People are going to be applying from. If somebody is saying that, you know, they go to Ebenezer Baptist Church, chances are they're Black. So there are other, and that's why, you know, affirmative action kind of left that murky spot for them to be able to mention it in their essays and the like. So this is a real challenge. One of the things I have in my book, Lies About Black People, is I have this thing called the Rule of Seven. And basically, it's seven questions to ask how committed you really are to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And one of the tests that's in the book talks about who are your closest friends, what do they look like, your closest neighbors, and the like. So with our universities, if I was to pose a question to them, what do your recruitment efforts really look like? Where are you going? Who are you targeting? Who is sitting on, what do the seven members of your committee look like? So are they people who are gonna have a racial justice tinge in mind? Are they gonna have a mindset that thinks about the communities where these people are coming, where different groups are coming from? Are they gonna look at the zip codes? Because those types of things have not been banned. But what I'm afraid of is that there are schools who are just, who've already wanted these policies to end, who are just going to be like, okay, we just got to stop all of it. And they're simply going to go by test scores and grades and call it a day. And those schools are definitely going to see their numbers decline dramatically.
So the Supreme Court ruling will be the justification they've been waiting for in order to be able to keep their populations white or increase the white proportionality. Now, we did see Neil Gorsuch agree on the issue of legacy admissions and the fact that, you know, and legacy admissions tend to be white. I mean, it is shocking to me that both your parents got PhDs from Harvard and you, an obviously brilliant person, didn't get in, which may suggest, I mean, just anecdotally, that race, that the race of non-white folks may counter any advantage you might have had as a legacy applicant, because the idea of legacy admissions originally was to maintain the supremacy on campus of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. These were policies that were created to keep out qualified Jewish Americans back in the day, right? But this Supreme Court ruling, if you're going purely by the law, this sets a precedent for undermining and undoing and making illegal legacy admissions that disproportionately benefit and unethically benefit wealthy white people. Do you hope to see a lawsuit undoing that? And can that help chip away at the overwhelming whiteness of campuses?
Absolutely. I expect to see more lawsuits and more challenges that are going to come forth. And that definitely gives me a lot of hope. And we also have to couple this with their student loan decision, right? Because that's also going to create a larger barrier for entry for people who don't have access to the resources to get there. I mean, even this whole concept of the rise of tuition, you know, started with people or got enhanced with people like Ronald Reagan, you know, really after, you know, coming out of seeing the student protests and the like, really wanted to create efforts to have financial barriers to not have basically what he called undesirables on these college campuses and universities. And so when you look at that decision as well with the affirmative action decision as well, there it's a double whammy as relates to working to reduce the numbers of non-white, wealthy white, non-white people who don't have the means to be there. And to be quite honest, there's another thing that I talk about in the book, Lies About Black People, is that there are a lot of poor white people who are celebrating these decisions as if it increases their opportunities to get into places like Harvard. And one of the things that they fail to realize is that they have more in common with marginalized black and brown communities as it relates to access to resources. And, you know, Fred Hampton realized that with the Black Panthers when he was working, that's one of the reasons he was assassinated, because he was working on a multiracial coalition. People like Reverend Barber with the Poor People's Campaign as well, they have to understand that we have to keep challenging the system. And so for those who are white and not of means, you need to be joining with us in this fight. You need to be joining with us and bringing these lawsuits to these campuses, because if we don't do this together, just like what happened at the end of Reconstruction when former enslaved people and poor white people were building the South together and the rich, wealthy class didn't like that, that's when we got Jim Crow after that. So if we don't realize we're all in this together now, then it might be too late. But I believe, I'm very optimistic that this is the wake-up call that many more people needed, not just us who are doing this work every day, many more people needed to get active. And I believe that we're going to see some good results from it.
Right. I'm so glad you brought up the fact that the Supreme Court, because it is related, Supreme Court struck down President Joe Biden's student debt relief program, which basically, you know, doesn't just impact those who hold debt now from their past educational 10 years, but those who are in college and, you know, taking out loans, and those who will be taking out loans to attend college in the future. And so then finally, let's talk about how Congress needs to really take up the mantle and legislate these issues. You started out talking about how the Democrats rested on their laurels and didn't protect things like affirmative action policies from future Supreme Court cases. What can Congress do? Because it doesn't preclude Congress from taking action after the fact either, right?
That's right. That's right. And well, first thing we have to do is we have to really fight actively to get control of the House again. And you know, with these other Supreme Court rulings relating to redistricting and the like, there's a very good chance that, you know, in Louisiana and Alabama, there's a very good chance that, you know, we can get more black more, I would say, Democrats, you know, elected to Congress who can, you know, help shift those numbers. You know, McCarthy has such a slim majority. Who knows what's going to happen with Santos? So, you know, if he goes to prison in the next year or so, who knows? But, you know, he only has like a very small majority, and we can flip that. And some of these other House members have been so ridiculous and abysmal in what they're doing that I feel like, you know, people like Boebert, you know, they can be defeated. So once we do that, we have the House has to be more proactive. And to be quite honest, in addition to doing things like codifying, you know, Roe v. Wade and other things, they actively have to look at expanding the Supreme Court. It was Congress that expanded the Supreme Court six times throughout the history. And I don't care what Biden says, with more pressure continually put on him. I mean, look at Biden's trajectory. I mean, there are many things that he supports now that he was absolutely not against, and some that he was not supportive of. Some of the things that we're fighting now, like, you know, prisons, these were things that he was all gung ho on. So we need to keep putting pressure on him. It's not illegal or political to change the courts. It has happened before in the past. We need to expand it. You know, I'm looking at, you know, my kids are 17, 14, and 8, and I'm looking at what their life is going to be like the next 40 years, and the rights that they've already lost that I've enjoyed in my experience, rights and policies. And so, yeah, we have to fight hard. Those of us who didn't fight hard enough to not get Trump elected, to not elect Trump, I should say, you know, get out there. This is your time to try to fight and make it up, right? Because once we do that, hopefully the Democrats, once we get them back into power again, will be able to realize we need to. They're playing checkers, and the Republicans, they're not even playing chess. They're playing like nuclear chess. Like, you don't think the Republicans will, you know, expand the Supreme Court if it suits their interest? I mean, look at what McConnell did to even get the Supreme Court the way it is now. So it's not political blowing up institutions. The Democrats need to be more strategic, and we're putting them in there to do just that. And on some levels, not all, but on some levels, you know, they let us down.
Yeah. And of course, it matters what type of Democrats we're talking about.
That's right.
There's a crop of newer, younger Democrats of color who are a lot more open to changing things up and taking bold
Yeah.
stances than the old guard. And we'll sort
No
of
Joe
see.
Manchins. No Joe Manchins. Nope.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And where can people find out more about your work, Omekongo?
Well, they can go to my website, upstanderinternational.com is where they can find out more information, or omekongo.com. And all the social media spaces, they can just check me out at omekongo. You know, we're also building out a webpage for Lies About Black People. And what we're going to be doing with that is, in the book, there are interviews where I talk about people and their anti-racist journey. And so we're going to be creating interview questions that people can also contribute to what we talk about in the book by posting their stories on our websites as well. So that's also where they're going to be able to find me. And of course, they can follow me on YouTube, you know, hear some of the poetry live that's in the book as well. Yeah, and I look forward to building with people and creating this community where everybody can be celebrated and not tolerated.
Thank you so much, and good luck to you with the book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Omekongo Dibinga, a professor of intercultural communication at American University, where he also serves as a faculty affiliate to the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. He's the author of the new book, Lies About Black People: How to Combat Racist Stereotypes and Why It Matters. And we've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's striking down of affirmative action policies in colleges and universities. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.